This is an oral history recording at Westminster School on Thursday the 14th of June 2018 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist, and
Mark Felton.
Okay. I'd like to ask our interviewees a little bit about their family background, just to get us started.
Sure. Right, well, I'm Australian, born in Melbourne. My dad did two degrees. He did a degree at University of Melbourne in classics, and then he did a law degree at Oxford, Magdalen Oxford, and then went back to Victoria to practice law. And the there's great similarities between state law in Victoria and British law, so it was probably an easy part. I think he didn't enjoy being a barrister. And so he started teaching a bit of classics at the university, including teaching, interestingly enough, the Rushbrook, Tebow and Martha's, do you know the Rushbrooks? Mm-hmm. Tebow and Martha's grandmother. So when my brother was born, Tebow and Martha's grandmother, these are two students I've looked after in college, their grandmother brought a little jumpsuit round to my parents' house in Carlton. Anyway, job came up at his old Oxford College, Magdalen, and he took the young family. This was just after I was born, took 1965, we would travel around by boat. And then he was there till he retired, and then he a few years later returned to Australia. My dad was from Shepparton. My mum was born in Bendigo. She's still alive, mum. She's come back now to live in Woodstock, which is where we lived in when I was at school, and you know, where I grew up. So Bendigo is a sort of dusty gold town in the Victorian gold rush, Victorian state and Victorian as in the monarch, so sort of in the late 19th century. And her uncle was great-uncle Ron, as we called him, Bishop of Bendigo. Both my parents' sides of the family had distinguished sort of war participants. So my granddad on my dad's side enlisted at the start of the Second World War and was one of the few Australians who were in the general staff of MacArthur. And he became basically the Allied expert on the Japanese air order of battle. So he was flown around the world, World War II. He had what I call a boy's own war, that he never really, whatever active service he saw. I mean, he used to go up in planes with the Americans. He was had a lot of great fondness for the American servicemen. And they used to take him out one or two outings, but it was kind of like, just for his own excitement. I don't think he really needed to. Anyway, so one of our treasures is we've got a letter from the Japanese surrender from General Willoughby, who's MacArthur's chief of staff to my granddad, thanking him for his war effort. And then he immediately left the services at the end of the war, and he was a politician and solicitor. And then on my mum's side, and this was great because this all came out, I showed you some of this, in fact, didn't I? This is my mum's uncle, so my grandma's brother, who World War One was joined up after Gallipoli, they merged the Gallipoli veterans with the new recruits. He was in the 56th Battalion, and he was at Fromel, where amongst the adversaries was Adolf Hitler. So 24 hours in Australian history, they call it, and it's a subsidiary of the Somme. It's not like the main Somme event. And then went through and we had to spend the winter in the Somme. Can you imagine that? An Australian who trains in... they train them in Egypt. There's a great book called An Anzac on the Western Front, and he features in that, actually. They train them in Egypt, they go over, and I think it's meant to be the coldest winter for many years, that winter in the Somme. And spends it there, and is then actually... He gets gassed, but he fights in a number of actions. He's at Passchendaele, he's at Arras, he's at Amiens. I think the other two, they should come in the other order. Ends up as a captain, gets a military cross. That's just after the Somme, winter in the Somme, he gets a military cross. All of that, I found out about great-uncle Garnet. That's Garnet Williamson, so my grandfather on the other side, Percy Felton. So Garnet Williamson, I only found out about that, you know, a couple of years ago when it was all the centenary of the Somme, because Australians have been very good digitising all their records. So you can find it all out online, and we found those lovely sketches that I showed you, which was terrific. So I guess we've always been, I mean, interestingly, with the family, they're real royalists. I mean, I didn't know my great-uncle, but who was in World War One. I knew great-uncle Ron, Bishop of Bendigo, very well. I knew my granddad, on my dad's dad, who was the World War Two veteran. I talked to him about World War Two when I was in my gap year. And my mum was this really staunch royalist as well. Always, still is. Yeah, my dad too. My dad believed in the divine right of kings. He was an academic lawyer. He asserted that, which caused interesting family debate. And so, like, a great moment was when I was at uni. I was in the same year, same college as Prince Edward, and there's a moment when Mum's asked to go to the loo, and so I wander over to a staircase, and Prince Edward holds the door open for her, you know, unexpectedly, and she nearly passed out. And so it's been great for her, I think, that I've seen me, because my dad died in 2004 before I got the college job. I mean, I was at Westminster, and I was going to be a housemaster, because I've been appointed to Wren's, and then sudden stroke and dies, age 71. But it's great for Mum, because she loves all that royal connection stuff, that, you know, all the stuff we've done through college and Queen's Scholars, etc. That's been terrific. I've just got to phone her up in a minute, actually. I told her about, because I met the Queen with the trip through the she opened the Triforium Galleries, and she the Dean told her what my next job was, and she went, "Good gracious, Austar, that will be a change." So I've forgotten the good gracious, but one of the girls was reminding me of that, which is fantastic. Yeah. So there, yeah. So that's my sort of, we kind of, you know, I think I probably would reform the royal family, but I guess I'm not a Republican.
And growing up in Woodstock, where did you go to school?
I went to a school called Squirrel School, which is on Oxford Road, for the children of the North London gentry. And then I was at the Dragon School, where, of course, in the year below me, I was actually should have been in the same year as Frances Ramsay, but she was in the year below. I was kind of put forward a year, which is, as we now know, is a terrible idea. and so I was at the Dragon School, and then I was at Winchester. That's when I was living in Woodstock, then Cambridge, after a gap year. So I had a great gap year when I went back to Australia. Been once after leaving when I was one, we'd gone over for Christmas in 1976, and then I spent 9 months there in the 80s, including travelling around a bit with Boris Johnson. That was quite fun, working alongside him for a bit. Probably the best time to have known Boris, as far as one can judge. But we still say hello when we bump into each other, which is nice. And he was a Westminster parent, of course. And then I did a PGCE at the Institute of Education.
So did you know straight away that you wanted to be a teacher? When did that realisation come?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, so I absolutely know at school. I mean, the way it worked, I was in a boarding house, and I used to, especially for my last 2 years, I did maths A-level really early. And so for my last 2 years, I was like the maths help in the house. And by the end of it all, I had sort of set up a pyramid structure, because so that I had people who I helped who were doing their last year A-level, and they helped the people. So people would come to me and say, well, no, you need to go and see them. And so I'd sort of set up my own little tutorial agency. Wasn't making any money, but I kind of enjoyed it. And then, you know, my mum was a teacher. My mum taught at a school in Begbrook, a convent school. My dad, obviously, a university lecturer, and Don. So it was kind of in the blood. And aforementioned great uncle Ron, funnily enough, was a maths teacher before he became a bishop. And so there's lots of teach. So you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I remember my dad saying at one point he'd be proud of, you know, he'd be very happy. Not say proud, but he'd be happy with either me or my brother being teachers. Remember that being said. And then I think there was a couple of moments really. There was one moment where I remember we had a, you know, one of our teachers falling asleep, Mr. Masson. He was a housemaster, and he fell asleep in the lesson. I remember thinking, nice way to make your money, you know. and then I probably wasn't really thinking so much about teaching the first couple of years at university, but I think I got quite politicised at university, so I was kind of keen to teach, kind of coming out of that. rather than going to banking or anything like that. So, yeah, so it was in the blood, really.
And some of your first experiences teaching were in the state sector?
Absolutely, well, 11 years, yeah. Remember I met, when I was at Cambridge, I met Jonathan Porritt, and he, the Defence of the Earth guy. And I told him, by that stage, I'd heard that that's what he was going to do. That's what he had done. He'd taught in the state sector in London. I had a little chat with him. And he said, well, you must do the training. And I was intending to anyway. So, yeah, PGC at the Institute of Education. Teaching practice at Parliament Hill School. And less time, but some time at Stoke Newington School. So Parliament Hill was very civilised. Sort of Michael Palin's daughter, that sort of thing. But also, it was a comprehensive. But, you know, had the sort of Hampstead gentry left side, sending their kids there. Stoke Newington was a really rough place. It was quite an eye-opener. And then first job was St Marylebone. Interestingly enough, my head at St Marylebone, John Stevenson, he got an OBE for turning it round. It was like a sink school that became now is one of the most successful state schools in London. So I've got the first head I've worked for and probably the last, both OBEs. I quite like that. And St Marylebone was an interesting school. I was there 2 years. It was in a period of transition. It was halfway through the Great Turnaround. And it was like a sort of high tide mark. The sort of year sevens and the year eights were in perfect uniform. And that was the year group he was seeing through. And then above that, it got a lot ropier. but it was great fun. And then I had 2 years at Burlington Danes, which was a really tough place to work. You know, 1,000 kids, you're always dealing with kids you didn't know. There would be quite a violent undercurrent, and sometimes, you know, massive, massive fights. And the worst one I saw was, you know, about 200 kids, you know, baseball bats, Wood Lane, traffic stopped. You know, that was really quite a tough place. And, you know, mainly fed by the White City Estate. And the other school, the other side, was Hammersmith School, which was the one which was notorious as being the worst school in the country. It's now called Phoenix, after it was burnt down. And it was burnt down whilst I was at Burlington Danes. Some year sevens put kerosene down in the science lab and torched it. But Burlington Danes, I was deputy head of maths there, and you know, I had a football team, which was great. So we won a couple of bits of silverware. We played at Fulham. Which was fantastic. That was good fun. Very talented kids. But yeah, hard work. And then I was head of maths at St Augustine's for 6.5 years. And yeah, that was, again, really tough school. Struggling to stay above the sort of failing threshold. I mean, we got the first round of Ofsteds when I was there. Just passed. And I think just passed because it was a remarkable place. It was had a remarkable ethnic mix. I remember the HMIs, when I did a year, I did some temporary senior management towards the end, and we had some Her Majesty's Inspectorate come round, and they said, you know, there's not a school like this for the mix. And, you know, well, they hadn't visited one. But again, attainment was very low. So when I started at St Augustine's that year, I started in at the start of the summer term, and that year 11, got 6 GCSEs or C or better. Okay, about 120. And we got up to about 30. That was the best we did. We got it kind of hold water at about 30. That was our sort of high watermark, rather, for a few years before I left. But really draining, really tough work. And I remember I only ever drank my coffee cold. And you have to pay for it as well. So you have to pay for your tea and coffee at break, and pay for your jam donuts at break, and pay for your lunch. And I'd always had this sort of Marks and Spencer's espresso instant coffee, and I'd always just drink it on the Hoover Coals because it made for me. And it was really, yeah, very draining work. And then I think I was basically burnt out. And job came up at Westminster initially, and I applied to two places. I applied to Harrow, applied to Westminster. It was about the time my first marriage was breaking up, so I think one of my referees put, I had some, you know, was experiencing some family troubles. My reference, Harry, weren't too interested. It's almost like a recommendation for Westminster at that time. And so I came to Westminster, didn't get the job. I had to wait for ages. I think Anne Carman got a bit sick of having to tell me every 3 weeks or whatever when I said, have you made your mind up yet? And I think they originally appointed Robert Will. And then more people left. It was kind of towards the end of the... what's the name of the cult? The music-based cult that was in the school. They never heard of this. Well, there was some, yeah. A couple of the maths teachers had got kind of caught up in this... the name will come to me at some point, this cult. A few teachers at the school became a big issue and they had to leave. And well, I said they had to leave. I'm not sure they were coming, you know, but it was thought good that they should leave. What's the name? Just about Ed, Gavin Griffiths would give you... Michael Davies would give you chapter names because he described how one of his Alston trips or something, he was in a minibus with one of these teachers. And as they sort of hit the motorway, the teacher said, let me tell you about this. And Michael was driving, all the kids were able to put their earphones in, you know, plug into their personal stereos, and Michael got 2 hours on it. Anyway, so those teachers left, and they needed a couple more, and they appointed myself and Nick Calavas. So I got the call back. After Howard said no, and Westminster said no, we had an Ofsted coming up, so I thought, no more applications. Get your head down and do this, see what comes up next. And then I got the call back and came in and got the job and started here in 1997, so 21 years ago. And I remember the first lunch I had when I was working. I mean, the first event actually was I got to play a bit of cricket for the staff team before I started. So Pink Elephants had a fixture and I came down and knocked a little, 39, I can remember exactly what I got. Against the Mandarins, I think it was, Vincent Square. So I got a little bat and a bowl, that was nice. And then I remember my first lunch in College Hall as a teacher. And, they put a load of chalk ices on the table at the end of lunch. And, I was kind of looking around to see, and so I had one. And no one seemed to be taking any note of what I was eating, so I had 6 in the end. But, you know, I wasn't like that much of a culture shock to me because I had been to an independent school, like, and I knew what it was like. I remember walking through Westminster at the time, and obviously I was quite used to, the places I worked before had all been, a lot rougher. And I remember walking through Westminster Yard when I arrived and thinking, these people, most boys think they're quite rough, and, it's probably a little rougher than I expected it would be. But it was still well below, but I thought, there was quite a bit of posing, a lot more posing in Yard those days than there are these days. It was kind of posturing, or maybe, it's very hard to tell, because obviously you see it through different eyes, the longer you're there.
And what was the maths teaching like at Westminster? Did that feel like a big contrast?
Well, I was doing things that, I was teaching areas of maths I hadn't taught before. I was teaching a lot more able students. I remember there was a couple of stories I tell. I mean, one is at the end of one of my first terms, I had my mark book and every kid had handed in every piece of homework. I mean, that was just so far off the scale of what I'd experienced before. Like St. Augustine's, it was good if you got 60% of it in. And that was a good day. I remember teaching a lesson on double derivatives, which I hadn't taught before. And it was a good single maths group early in the year. And I knew I hadn't taught it well. I've been doing enough teaching to know, you haven't quite got that right. And so I went in the next lesson and said, okay, folks, we didn't quite get that right, so we'll go again. And this wonderful kid called Thomas Munby, who I think was the first head of house for Milnes, which opened the next year, Milnes, said, it's okay, sir, we got together, we looked it up, and we've got it. And I thought, right, I'm not used to that, I can work with this. So in that sort of sense, it's try stop them learning. And the challenge at Westminster, I guess, is A, to answer the really, you know, the searching questions you get from the really, really good kids. B, obviously, to help that everyone achieve their kind of potential. And with the kids who find maths a bit harder, and they still find it pretty easy by national standards, to help them get the best grades they can. And I think also there's a whole sort of business of, I remember hearing one or two people sort of say, well, you know, you don't have to set these kids prep and everything. And they're right. You know, they were still in the sense that, you know, the majority of kids will do very well without too much prep. On the other hand, that was a challenge to actually set them homework that is appropriate and interesting and, you know, moving things forward. So I kind of always in the back of my mind had a bit of, when I heard that sort of thinking, you're just taking a soft option and you don't really know quite how lucky you are to be driving this Maserati that you're driving. Yeah, so, and there was differences in style, but I mean, I think in many ways, I think the maths teaching approach, the maths department's approach to teaching has changed over the time I've been here, and it's kind of come more towards what I was, you know, I mean, I certainly in the first few years moved towards what Michael would want me to be doing, and I think then his teaching style's evolved a lot in the last 20 years.
Because he's been head of department all of this time.
Yep. And we've never once had an argument. And I may have a reputation for not managing up very well with some people. You do point that out to them. Michael never had a problem with me. Wonderful to work for him. I mean, what a, you know, fantastic, inspirational, knowledgeable. You know, he brings out the best in people. You want to do your best for him. You want to do your best for the department. There's tremendous loyalty in the maths department. In many ways, if you look at who he was managing, he had James Gazzet while he was on the way up, and Robert Wilm. He had TJP. He had Eddie Smith, both who'd run the department. He had Nick Calavas and myself, both who had been heads of department. You know, he had an enormously experienced team, but that can be problematic. And I don't think he had problems with any of them. I think we all recognised his, you know, ability, and also wanted to work with him, moving things in the direction he wanted to go. So a really inspirational head of department and fabulous person to work for, and a friend. You know, Michael's a really good friend.
When did you start thinking about becoming a housemaster?
I was kind of aware that it might happen quite early on. There was a fair amount of change. And I remember I had a chat with TJP at one point. And I think in that chat, he might have mentioned housemastering, and I'd have said, well, not so much my thing, because it wasn't. I was more academic route, departmental responsibilities and things like that. But looking back, I think he then put me to a side with it, you know, just thought, well, Mark doesn't want to be a housemaster. So various ones came up, and I was thinking I might be asked, and I wasn't, or I might be asked if I was interested, and I wasn't, and which was fine, because I got the responsibility of running the cricket very early on, which was amazing, because cricket's my great love. And so it's very odd to be working, you know, in many ways, your principal responsibility is a big job running the cricket, to be what has always been your great passion and your great love. So that was extraordinary. I did that for 4 years. And then I was one of the two inaugural heads of year. So that was, I think when I got that job, that was kind of teeing me up. As it is now, it tees people up for being housemasters. And I think it was myself and John Curtis who started off as the first 2 years of year. So it wasn't long after that that Rents came up. And I was absolutely ready to do that. And there was a huge amount of time between working out it was me and taking over, because I think John Arthur, he was the sort of lead domino in the whole thing, and he did his 10 years in Rigos, and so it was flagged up from a time when he would go. And I think he decided after an Easter term, because that kind of works quite well with UCAS. And so Keith got Rigos, and then I got Wren's when Keith moved on. And fabulous taking over from Keith. I mean, enormous respect for and ran a fabulous house. And John too, I mean, great figures. So yeah, that was Wren's. So I think I'm the only person on an archival note to have been pastorally involved in the three houses in the college dormitory. So tutor in Dryden's, and I used to teach in Dryden's under Mark Tocknell, housemaster in Wren's, and then college. And there was always a great banter and relationship and energy between Wren's and Dryden's. They were really friendly neighbours. You know, the two remove rooms were next to each other. And so there'd always be that healthy exchange of people in one room or another. So that was great, the Wren's Dryden's access. I thought it was wonderful for me when Martin Bolton, who's a great friend, became... I had Mark Tocknell's housemaster of Dryden's, who I knew and got on with very well. And then Martin Bolton, who was a great friend, was in Dryden's when I was in Wren's. So that worked really well.
And you're quite unusual among the staff in having moved from a day house and then on to college.
Is that unusual?
I think it used to be a lot more common than it is now.
Yeah.
I was trying to think before our interview of other people, other housemasters now, who've done more than one house.
Oh, yeah.
And I couldn't really think
of it. Well, Gavin Griffiths.
But people who've gone now.
Yeah, but in college in particular. I don't know if anyone did another house before college. Is that right?
I can't think of anyone recently who has done another house.
No, I mean, I'm thinking back to what John Carlton might have done.
I think John Carlton did, possibly, though
I'm not sure.
Entirely sure, actually.
But definitely not Jonathan Katz, Jim Coben. A good thing. Mm. I mean, I think because it worked well in the sense that I had good relationship with the Wren's parents, and then the parental word of mouth, you know, college parents and I mentioned, I noticed how it was interesting, I mentioned the parents before the pupils, but the college parents were well briefed, what to expect. And I knew a lot of the pupils anyway, because I mean, teaching and also with football and cricket, because when I started being a housemaster, you know, people like Jeremy Kemble were still running football whilst being a day housemaster, and I was running a football team for my first few years and involved in the cricket, though less so once I stepped down from the first level. That was a big change in terms of the amount of hours. So you know a lot of students through that, and you know a lot of people you teach. I'd already been at the school, would it be over 10 years? So in that sense, I was pretty much in the fabric. It takes you quite a few years to feel like you've settled into Westminster. I mean, the estate schools I was at, it was, you know, if you came back for the next term, you know, they didn't quite welcome you with open arms, but it was noted that you'd come back, you know, and especially St Augustine's, or to a lesser extent Burlington Downs. Whereas Westminster, it really took 3 or 4 years to feel like you'd settled in.
And how did the change to college happen? Was it a sort of tap on the shoulder when the job came up?
Well, Francis got the job and that was quite... I think that was in a Lent term. So Francis gets Queen's Harley Street. And I don't know if... I think I might have even just... I think I mentioned to Gary Savage I was interested. And they had a little interview processes. Couple of other people interested. I got the call from Stephen. I remember I was at home in Wembley one Sunday night and got the call from Stephen. Remember that? That's how it all happened quite quickly. Whereas Wren's have been this prolonged wait, you know, with college you hear in the East, in the Lent term, and you're in the next, you know, in September and up and started.
And how different was it being in a boarding house?
It's quite different. I mean, so it's a big responsibility in the sense that they don't go home. You know, I mean, that's it. I mean, if you've had a bad day and a lot of it, I guess, in terms of responsibility and weight, are about bad days, about what's the worst that can happen. Obviously, all the good stuff that can happen, well, that's a pleasure, and you breeze that. And a lot of the work is good, but what's the worst that can happen to you as a boarding house master? Well, it's the unmentionable, really. Yeah. And so you live with that weight on your shoulders. And, you know, if I told you my worst encounters, they're absolutely frightful. And things I took a lot of time to get over, but I probably ought not to put them on record. But, you know, along that line, sort of, what's the worst that could happen, how close we came. So you live with that weight. You takes a lot, initially, there's a whole sort of question of sort of ownership of the space. I remember Jim Cogan telling me a great story about when he had taken over, because I was really good friends with Jim. I used to chat a lot. I thought it was a great disappointment to me that Jim didn't get to know that I got the job. Though obviously I talked quite a bit to Jenny about it. That when Jim in his early days goes into the door into college, and one of the pupils comes and stands in front of him and says, "Well, yeah, can I help you?" Blocks his way. Well, no one blocked Jim's way for very long. And so you get that initial... I was lucky, I had a lovely remove, but I did have to, you know, set my stall out early on. I'm a bit of a control freak. And so it took me about a year. I can remember, again, probably not fair to say exactly what the circumstances are that tell me that. Remember, it took me about a year and a half to get it where I really wanted it. And then there were odd occasions too, such as the first time you turn all the lights off and walk through the building in the dark. That's quite spooky the first time you do that. And now I just do it. I can just absolutely know every step. When I turn left, exactly what's where, no problems. When all the kids have gone and I'm turning the lights off.
And I wanted, actually, that brings me on. I wanted to talk to you about living in number three.
Yeah.
And of course, all the ghost stories associated with that house. And
There's more with grants on there.
Well, possibly, yes.
I'm definitely kind of my metaphysical moments and my transcendental moments when I didn't bother me, and I didn't have any odd experiences in number three. I mean, I definitely felt in the dormitory, you felt that what I would call a weight of memory, walking through it with the lights off. I felt that as a sort of weight of memory. But yeah, number three, there's the you think about the Rayner book.
Mm.
Well, he talks more about the Abbey, doesn't he?
Well,
the Abbey door and everything. That's a beautiful book. I remember asking Jonathan Katz about that, and him saying, yes, well, I think we might have left some of our own spirits. And he had a great story about number three, about when... I think everyone who lives there, it's an amazing place to live. It is a bit of a goldfish bowl. It's odd the way, I mean, I didn't get the whole house. I got the flat, so you go out into this communal stairwell to access your bedroom. And I also had, I suppose, Freddie growing up there, which is like Jim. I think with Jonathan Katz, he had... Joe went to Winchester, didn't he? And with Francis's... kids were a bit younger, so we all had different sort of family circumstances. But you can sit in that great drawing room, and that's a fabulous room to relax in. I think I was quite territorial, perhaps, compared to some of my predecessors in terms of I needed a space for my family. I think other people made it more a space for the house. But... at the same time, the housemaster job had changed so that the housemaster was expected to be in the house a lot more. I mean, that really was a transition over my time in the school, that housemasters were expected to be a presence a lot, and in a good way. And I think you can do it in a good way without being too intrusive. And so I was in, you know, they weren't going to be in my bit when I'm in their bit. So, yeah, living in number three was, a great experience. And I was going to tell you about the Jonathan Katz had this story about how when he took over, Jim did have a go at trying to persuade him that number three didn't come with the job. How would he feel about, how would he feel about, you know, if Jim stayed in number three? And I think Jonathan let him know how he felt about that. And Jim moved out, which is quite funny. So yes, I think, you know, I think if you ask the College Society, who you know, I have a sort of notoriously fractious relationship with, they would refer to it as a public place. And it's certainly not that in my time. But yeah, light living there, interesting, and takes a bit of while to settle into because you are right in the middle of it all, but you just get used to it.
And then one of the other things you've already touched on is, of course, that special role that you have within the Abbey, that special relationship, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, I think I'm very lucky in that I've for my time, we've had John Hall as Dean. I think John Hall's engagement with the school has been absolutely superb. He would come and have debates with the scholars in the evening. I'm trying to think of the things he'd have brought in. So we, rather than having tea and coffee in after an Abbey Eucharist in number three, we have it in Jerusalem Chamber. And so he'd be there with the canons and the minor canons. And so there was a much closer relationship, I think, between Abbey and school, and as I understand it. I mean, I'm really going on kind of hearsay because I didn't work with Wesley. Or who's before Wesley? Is one of the carpenters? Is it?
Edward, yeah.
And is it Michael Main before that?
Yes.
I mean, only got
shaky
this,
on the order.
Yeah.
Yes.
But John Hall is an absolutely wonderful person who, and he's been very good at involving the scholars in events. So the most recent example will be with the Queen and the Triforium Gallery, where less than 48 hours before the Queen actually visited, we managed to get this arranged for the scholars to line the way out so that she could meet some of the girls, Queen scholars, as well as no one else in the house up to that point had had a royal event. But yeah, I mean, I mean, I count him as a friend and a very special person. And for me, with the Abbey, I ended up, because they send you a little list to fill in for when the scholar's going to read on the Sunday service. William Nicholson, one of the secretaries to one of the minor canons, does that. And so I just started filling them in and saying, look, let me know if you have any blanks, I'll do them for you. And so I ended up on the Abbey reading list, which is nice. So I would, for a number of Sundays, a good number of Sundays, I'll just go on my own and got to know the Abbey congregation. There's a small congregation of regulars in the Abbey, as well as all the tourists. And got to read a number of, they were very, very kind about my readings, and I got to read a number of the special occasions as well as the more regular ones. And so in that sense, I became quite well ingrained with the Abbey community. So in many ways, coming back, I'd probably visit the Abbey before I visit the school, funnily enough. And a lot of those figures would be there, like Tony Trowles. I mean, all of the...